Chapter 14. What Grandma and Daisy had been doing all morning was picking daisies in a field the other side of the village. They had begun to collect their daisies there because it was well away from Unicorn House, and Grandma wished to keep this activity secret for as long as possible. The scheme had been hatched up the previous day and was Grandma's brainchild. "We shall probably need a million daisies," she had told a wide-eyed Daisy. "But we can't pick a million daisies, Grandma Bag," Daisy objected. "We're too old and too young." "We shall delegate," Grandma said. "Have you any friends?" "Not exactly friends," Daisy admitted. "Excepting Arioch." "Arioch will be left strictly out of this enterprise, Daisy," Grandma told her. "Is that clearly understood?"
"Yes, Grandma Bag," said Daisy meekly.
"I don't suppose he has ever picked daisies in his life," Grandma went on, "and would certainly not know how to make a chain." What Grandma and Daisy were going to do was make the longest daisy chain in the world. This would ensure their joint immortality in the shape of an entry in the Guinness Book of Records, Grandma said. "And what is more," she added, "it is a very beautiful, poetic, and symbolic gesture. Even Celia would admit that."
"Why is it, Grandma Bag?" inquired Daisy.
"Because, dear child, your name is Daisy," Grandma told her, "and because a daisy chain is an intrinsically poetic thing. More poems have been written in the English language about daisy chains than any other subject. Now, what about these friends of yours? We shall not be able to pick a million daisies single-handed." Daisy had supplied the names of several small girls in the village, who she thought might help, particularly as Grandma intended to offer them an inducement. That morning, Grandma had telephoned 9 or 10 of them, promising a signed poster of Zero for each plastic carrier full of daisies. "Though the stems must be long," she warned, "I do not want bags full of daisy heads with half-inch stems. No stems, no poster. And this is a secret. If you tell, no poster." Jack himself, of course, as yet knew nothing of this. As he approached the stile on the outskirts of the village, the first heavy drops of rain began to fall. He hurried his step, and was amazed to see what at first sight looked like a horde, but was probably around a dozen, of small girls, squealing and running pell-mell toward him, carrying plastic carriers. This had a very odd effect on Jack. He had just seen Daisy and Grandma with their carriers. He knew that they were set on some deadly enterprise, and now here was an army they seemed to have enlisted. Their rings were widening ominously beyond their immediate family into the outside world. The implications of this were frightening. Jack stood and let the little girls stream past him over the stile, squealing and giggling, their hair already soaked. Jack stood aside, not out of politeness, but in the hope that one of the fugitives might fall and tip out the contents of her carrier. He was even tempted to give one of them a push. When they were all gone, Jack and Zero themselves set off at a run over the wet grass, while the squeals of the Unholy Alliance's mercenaries faded into the distance. Grandma and Daisy arrived home some 20 minutes later than Jack, themselves considerably wet. They went cheerfully upstairs to change into dry things, and Jack noted that they did not have their carriers. "Perhaps," he thought with relief, "whatever they're going to do, they're not going to do it here." He was mistaken in this assumption. They were going to do it there, but in view of the news given them by Jack, Grandma proposed to change the timing of the enterprise. "We shall do it tomorrow," she had told Daisy. "This rain is exactly what we need to keep the daisies fresh. We will secrete them in the shrubbery for the time being." The plastic sacks, then, were at the present time concealed among some laurels in the drive, to have their contents properly spread out later. Daisy and Grandma reappeared just as lunch was being served, bright-eyed, and their hair still hanging in damp ringlets. Mr. Bagthorpe eyed them keenly. "Where have you been?" he demanded. "Out in the rain, Henry dear," she replied, "as I should have thought was apparent." "You know perfectly well what I mean," he told her. "You know perfectly well that you and Daisy are about to make a concerted pitch for immortality, and I want an assurance from you now at this moment that you will not do this tomorrow in this house. If such an assurance is not forthcoming, Daisy departs forthwith.
"Tomorrow is rather an important day for Henry, you see, dear," Mrs. Bagthorpe told Grandma.
"He is to be interviewed and photographed by the Sunday Times."
"So I understand," replied Grandma, "and I congratulate him. Daisy and I will not make our attempt tomorrow in this house."
This carefully worded assurance seemed to satisfy Mr. Bagthorpe, though he should have been alerted by the readiness with which it was given. Because he had not considered the possibility that this attempt would be made tomorrow in the garden. Daisy and Grandma exchanged smiles that only Jack seemed to observe. After lunch, Mr. Bagthorpe proposed to drive the family into Isham to change library books and so on. He could not, he told them, sit still in his study because of nervous agitation. "It is part of the heavy price of genius," he told them. Most of the family opted to go with him. Jack announced his intention of remaining behind. He felt this to be his duty. Grandma and Daisy, in their present volatile state, needed constant supervision. Unfortunately, his mother insisted that he go. His hair needed cutting, she said, and so did William's. "You may have your photographs taken tomorrow," she told them, "and I wish to feel proud of you." Mr. Bagthorpe endorsed this, saying that while he fervently hoped the Sunday Times would not photograph them, or indeed any other members of the family, if by chance they did, he, Mr. Bagthorpe, did not wish to appear as having fathered so hirsute a tribe. Jack nearly told his parents his reason for wanting to remain behind, but felt confused as to where his loyalties lay. He had no real wish to sabotage Daisy and Grandma, who at any rate did not shout at Zero and constantly undermine him as Mr. Bagthorpe did. He decided to keep his mouth shut and let things take their natural course. When the Bagthorpes arrived back at tea time, things had taken a considerable course. As they entered the drive, Jack thought he caught a glimpse of one of the decorators up a tree. This seemed so unlikely an eventuality that he did not at the time mention it. The front door was ajar, so there was evidently someone about, though it did not feel as if there were. The house had an abandoned air that was at first hard to pinpoint, and then... "The decorators," exclaimed Mrs. Bagthorpe, "they are not supposed to leave until 5:30. She ran to the dining room and flung open the door, and saw to her relief that all tins of paint were tightly closed, according to her instructions, and that the walls were not toad color, as she had half expected, but still eau de Nil. "Mother," she called, returning to the hall. "Daisy!" There was no reply. At this point, Jack decided to mention the decorator up the tree.